Good morning. Today is March 19th, and it's bright and early, 8:35 and 8:36 in the morning. This is the Education Subcommittee for Ways and Means, and the only comment I want to say is before we start, because did you have anything you wanted to share, Doug?
I'll sort of talk through the day.
Okay, is, you know, today's the first day of the NCAA tournament, so I hope everybody's got their brackets done and you're ready to go. And
it's the first day of spring, too.
Well, more like tomorrow at 3:45, but it's okay. Close enough. Or today.
I don't know that, you know, if I have to leave and go turn on my TV in my office to see the 9:45 game, if Deputy Superintendent Saxton doesn't quite finish, you better be finished by 9:45. Okay.
But if don't use up all his time talking. No.
Well, I know. I only used 2 minutes. Doug Wilson,
Mr. Chair,
what do you have for us?
Just to make sure folks understand the agenda for today, Department of Education is up first. I expect Mr. Saxton to be a Federal Express sales or commercial, if possible. And then finish off Department of Ed with Lisa from the Chief Financial Office. I will do, because I need to go to a meeting at 9, I will do the sheet that I promised on sort of what's in and what's out of the $60 million consideration on Monday prior to at the beginning of that meeting. And then if Mr. Saxton finishes today, when Mr. Saxton finishes today, Ben Cannon is here to start the HEC presentation. So with that, Madam Chair.
Okay. With that, we carried over House Bill 5016 and House Bill 5017, and we're going to finish it up. We're going to make the home stretch of this Kentucky Derby race. Let's do it.
Co-Chairs Monroe and Comp, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Saxon, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction. I will try to be very concise and brief today. We'll run a fast break, as Rep. Comp might think that we should do. And so I have a couple of questions from yesterday I wanted to answer, and you should have a sheet at your table. The first question is about the number of school students from the Oregon School of the Deaf attending college. And what you would see is that in 12-13 and 13-14, relatively close to the same numbers, we had 12 graduates in the class of 13 and 23 graduates in the class of 14. Of those, 39% remained in the adult transition program at the Oregon School for the Deaf, and 22% went on to post-secondary programs that were either university AA or certificate programs. We have 12 students in the graduating class this year, and 3 have currently received acceptance letters from colleges. So, number 2, are homeless students eligible for nutrition programs up to the age of 21 years? You ask questions, I learn things. The answer to this is yes, they are. Lots of students who are homeless also attend school at the same time, and so obviously they are eligible. So I think maybe the real question is, are students who are homeless and who don't attend school eligible for child nutrition programs? And the answer is yes, through the age of 18, through the community nutrition program. Oftentimes those food service programs are delivered in places other than schools, but are still part of the same general program under some different regulation a little bit. But those meals might be delivered in parks or shelters or lots of other places as well, not just at schools, but it's all part of the same program. Number 3, what business partners are involved with ODE's CTE programs? We're still compiling that list, and I should be able to get that to you on Monday. I apologize for not having it today. It was just a few too many pieces to put together. So my apologies on that. And with that, I'd pick up at slide 249, which is about grant programs for teachers and other school district personnel. It's become really clear, and I don't know why it hasn't been really clear for a long time, but certainly over the last 5 to 7 years, that how capable educators are makes a really big difference in student learning. I know that sounds super simplistic, but for years I think we've chased programs or curricula or a whole bunch of different ideas that are going to fix things somehow. And the bottom line is how good the educators are who are working in the school system makes the biggest difference. And so it's really important that we work on this. And when I say educators, I mean teachers, very important, and administrators. I'm a little bit surprised in this position as I look at what's happening in different places, how much administrators matter, and how often the teachers, where there's a strong administrator, are also really great teachers. Yep. And so there's a lot of work that goes into that. So we have two really specific grant programs in ODE's budget that I want to target that support Oregon's educators, and they include Title IIA Teacher Quality, which is a federal grant. We get $46 million biennially for that program, and then also the Network of Quality Teaching and Learning, which had $45.6 million over the last biennium. The Title IIA Teacher Quality Federal Grant, again, $46 million biannually that can only be used to support professional development around teaching. That's a really important component. These funds can only be used to support professional development around teaching. 96% goes out in grants to districts. The department keeps about 3% of that. And they're allocated on a federal formula basis using population and poverty data. And they serve virtually all educators in the state. And 96% of the money is controlled locally. So local decisions made by local districts about what they're going to do with it. They need to turn in a plan to the Department of Education that is approved to make sure that it's meeting the federal guidelines. And we review those when we monitor and so forth. But those are all agreed to and created locally. We have a related key performance measure, KPM 14, around highly qualified teachers, and the goals for 100% of core academic classes being taught by highly qualified teachers. The actual, for the latest data that we have in 2012, is that 98% of teachers were, so we're very close to that.
Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair.
Sorry. Yes, Representative Huffman.
Where's that gavel? Rob, are either one of these related to or connected with the Chalkboard class program, or is that different somewhere?
Co-Chairs Comp and Rural Representative Huffman, yes. Within the strategic initiatives that are part of the general fund, and it was the $45.6 million that are referenced in network quality for teaching and learning, and I'm going to get into that here in just a second.
Okay.
There's something that's called the collaboration grants, and I think it was $11.5 million in the last biennium, and that $11.5 million runs from us to Chalkboard and out to the districts who are part of that process, and it is very effective and has really made a difference in the kind of teaching that we see teachers engaged in and the way that districts think about how they do their work around supporting teachers to be effective. It's a really nice program.
You're going to elaborate?
I am going to talk about that a little bit. So I asked Sarah Pope, who's Chief of Staff at the Oregon Department of Education, to join me around the strategic initiatives, and part of it is because Sarah is an encyclopedia around the strategic initiatives, and also because out of the last session, these bills were signed into law in mid-August, and we sat in front of this group and other groups and made a guarantee that we were going to move all these dollars out in a time frame on a schedule that we set up, and it ended up meaning that we had over 33 different grants, 1,500 different grant recipients, and we hired about 100, we added about 150 FTE to the department. Many of those were new hires to even be able to run this program, and it was a huge piece of work. And Sarah, she and Cindy Hunt and Sue McGlashan and some others were part of the team that pulled this off, and it was a really big piece of work, and I just wanted to make sure that I recognized Sarah and a few other people who did that, because it made a difference in the credibility of the department, and also I think what students received over the last 2 years in the state of Oregon. And there are others like Dye, Jonna Timms, that I should mention as well, and I'll move on or I'll lose my fast break mojo. So in this section, it's the final 30 slides, and it's from 252 to 282. I'm going to be talking about the strategic initiatives, what they were in 13-15, and some of the results and learning as a result of those grants, and also what we're seeking in 15-17. The idea is that our strategic investments will target key points along the school pathway in our P-20 system, and if you can make a difference along that pathway, that our outcomes for students will change over time. The specific targets are more students are ready for school, that'd be kindergarten ready, that more students are reading at third grade, that they're on track by the end of ninth grade, that they're completing high school and that are college and completion and are ready for the world of work. And so it is this pathway, and I'm sure you've seen this graphic several times out of the Oregon Education Investment Board. There are two key initiative areas that came out of the 13-15 session. One was called the Strategic Initiative for Student Success, or House Bill 3232, which received $29.3 million focused on three areas: early reading, post-secondary aspirations, and connecting to the world of work. And the second was called the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning, which was House Bill 3233, and again, $45.6 million focused on Oregon's educators in order to improve the quality of teaching and learning across the state. Combined, there were over 33 initiatives, more than 1,200 grants. I said 1,500 earlier. I think that's closer to correct. Made to school districts, ESDs, charter schools, post-secondary institutions, community-based organizations, and tribes. All school districts, 100% of all school districts, received at least two grants. Partners included the Oregon Department of Education, the Arts Commission, State Library, Oregon Education Investment Board, and Bureau of Labor and Industry. Here you can see a map of the districts in the state of Oregon and how many grants each received. The initiatives were grant heavy, and we're significantly moving away from grants. So we had lots and lots of grants in this whole deal, and we're moving away from grants pretty significantly as we seek a continuation of these efforts in 15-17. There were just too many challenges with all of the grants and small districts, which we worked hard to ameliorate. Had some challenges in being competitive in applying for the grants. And there were sometimes sums of money that were too small, and maybe this was a little bit not as focused as we could be, which is some of the learnings out of this work. On the other hand, we also really learned what worked, and we incubated some good ideas, and we had lots of learning on our part. None of the funds were wasted. I'm not saying that at all. And student learning was enhanced wherever those grants were run to ground. Most districts had between 3 and 8 grants, while 2 had more than 9, and you can kind of see that on this. I'll take 1 second here to, take 1 second here to just show you this is a map of Oregon, and this is live on the web, and we can send you this connection if you'd like to take a look at this and play with it and see what happened with your own school district. But as I go down this, you can see these colors are, this is no longer based on how many grants they received, but it's based on how much money was received by each district. And you can see that it runs from anywhere from, you know, as little as $2,000 to up to $4 million. And if you come and hover over one of these districts, and I'll just happen to wildly choose this one, and you click on it, it will tell you what happens. So this is the North Santa Ana School District, how much money they received, and what it was for. And so you can continue to play with that. I just happened to be hitting Representative Springer's districts for fun.
I noticed.
Just random. Where the mentoring grant, by the way, the one grant that isn't on here is the mentoring grant. And the mentoring grant for Lebanon received $92,000 in mentoring because they had a number of brand new teachers last year. And so the total for Lebanon was $221,000 out of these two strategic initiatives. They also received $46,000 for Common Core implementation and $80,000 for Focus and Priority Schools and $3,000 for Aspire. And so, again, you can go through and do that. Multnomah, what was I looking for here? North Wasco. Hood River County. So Hood River was very successful in writing grants. The superintendent in Hood River is pretty articulate and pretty was very aggressive about this. He told me we're going to apply for 8 and we're going to get 8. I think they got 7. And so you can go through the list and take a look at what those are. And Dan Goldman's the superintendent there, and Dan is will go get that kind of thing. So.
I thought those grants were successful.
Just a minute. Senator Thompson is recognized for the record.
Thank you. I got to get in here. I thought those grants were given because of the effectiveness of the representatives or the senators in those districts.
That's what he's trying to show. If you can't, I already figured that out.
Oh, okay. I'm good now.
Yeah. Okay.
Go Co-chairs Kampf and Rose, Senator.
Yeah, let's move
Senator
on.
Thompson, absolutely correct.
Oh, great.
Unless there was not as much, and that was all the superintendent's
right.
fault.
Yeah.
So this is our webpage, and we, you know, put a link on here about strategic initiatives right on the front of the webpage so that people can find it. And there's all kinds of information behind that, so that districts could access the information that they needed. This is the same thing I just showed you, only not live, and that brings us to 258. As stated earlier, House Bill 3232 resources were designed to support evidence-based strategies to improve student learning and close achievement gaps, and they were specifically targeted at kindergarten readiness, third grade reading proficiency, ninth grade progress towards graduation and high school completion, and college enrollment. We had an expanded reading investment of $30,000 for each year for focus and priority schools. And it was a resource that was used to improve student reading according to the local school improvement plan, so the design plan that they put together as part of their focus and priority effort. The total spend over the biennium was $3.5 million, and the money specifically focused on students in kindergarten to grade 3 and could be spent on any of three strategies: before and after school opportunities, so extended time, increased access to technology, and increased adult support. I think one of the biggest lessons learned about this was that the extended time worked very well, as did the increased adult support. And in fact, if you look at our age 3 to grade 3 literacy initiative, you'll find those two things deeply embedded in our recommendation. And what we found didn't work as well was increased access to technology, and that where technology was used, where these dollars were used to purchase technology, we really didn't see the kind of bump that we would want to see for the use of the dollars. And that extended time and improved instruction were a better use of resource. We have a couple great examples.
Just a second, Rob.
Yes.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Have you figured out why that is yet? Are there any indicators in that data?
Co-Chairs Compton and Rowe, Representative Springer. When I talk, I don't have anything that I can, anything except for what is relayed to me by our school improvement team that's working with our focus and priority schools specifically. And what they would tell me is that too often the technology is delivered and we haven't spent the time to make sure that people are prepared to use it in a really effective way. And that when we spend time on the instructional component of this is how you can use this to improve instruction, that it turns into a good tool. And when we don't do that, it just isn't as good a tool. And so it gets right back to the part of making sure that our educators are given every opportunity to be as effective as possible with whatever tool it is that they're using.
Go ahead, Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Are we talking about smart boards? Are we talking about iPads in the classroom? What are we talking about?
Co-Chairs Compton, Rural Representative Springer,
yes. Tools.
We saw all kinds of different things, sets of iPads, for classroom sets of iPads, for examples, or Google Chromes, projection devices, smart boards, and the like. And it's not that those things aren't great. It is that it takes some time to do the kind of necessary staff development to make sure that people are ready to use them. And so handing that to someone without a bunch of time isn't as effective as doing some training up front and then making that move.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
So Chief Joseph Ockley Green, K-8 school in Portland, is a great example. They reported an 18% improvement in reading achievement for their third graders, which is pretty phenomenal. And that was achieved through hiring a reading specialist who worked closely with students needing the most support and also providing professional development for teachers for improved reading instruction on a regular basis, daily ongoing within their classroom. Another grant which focused on reading was through the enhancement to the Oregon Response to Intervention Network. Oregon Response to Intervention Network is a system taking response to intervention to scale across the state. It's a project that's been underway through the use of federal dollars at the rate of about $2.2 million per biennia for the past approximately 8 years, so 4 biennia. All federal dollars have been used to support the program. But it became part of the strategic initiative work that added $2 million over the 13-15 biennium. And these grants doubled the capacity to support districts in this important work that was working and underway. Specifically, the initiative helps districts implement response to intervention as a method for identifying specific learning disabilities. So it's a way to identify students who would be eligible for an IEP, for special education. But the methodology really says we're going to quickly screen all students as they come into school and figure out where they are as far as their capacity for reading, and if there are any deficits in their reading skill, and then apply instruction that's tailor-made for that student based on that quick screening, and then measure progress over time. So there would be several measurements over the course of the year. And if a student doesn't make progress, then there's a referral for special education identification or an intensification of the of a different kind of instructional methodology. And it's what we have found over time is that schools who use response to intervention typically identify fewer students for special education, which isn't what you would think would happen, right? It's sort of a process about special ed identification, but it actually refines that identification, and it causes students who showed up maybe just not ever having access to learning to read, and it intensifies their instruction immediately, and we find that it wasn't that they had a disability that caused them not to be able to read, but they've never had access to instruction around reading or learning around reading, and that instead of identifying them then for special ed because we give them a wait to fail opportunity, we deal with it very quickly and figure out if it's a learning disability or if it is that they haven't had that opportunity to learn to read. And we actually develop readers instead of waiting for students to fail and then identifying them for special education. The other methodology for identifying special education is when there is a gap that's evidenced through assessment. And you cannot evidence that gap until you wait long enough for the gap to manifest itself. So these are two really different methodologies, and RTI has been great in districts across the state. So in slide 262, you'll see that there are 84 districts now and 43% of the state's K-12 population that are involved in the Oregon Response to Intervention Project. And the brown color indicates added districts that were added during the last 2 years, and there are 25 of them because we doubled down on the effort. The red dots are the regional centers where we have staff who support districts working on the response to intervention implementation. And there are four of those red dots that are spread across the state. And it's become a really effective program. The Oregon Response to Intervention.
Representative Springer.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I was hesitating, but I'm not going to hesitate any longer. So Lebanon School District was doing RTI 10 years ago, probably. Some of the principles behind that, not in this method. In fact, I co-presented at a conference with the principal when I was on the board. And just to illustrate this, it was rolling out. It was a new thing. People were looking at it and dabbling in it. And I remember the principal saying that long ago, this should help us identify kids sooner. As a brief example of that, our son kind of had some struggles, but he seemed pretty good. He was a Springer kid, and he had parents all over him, so he'll be fine. And I was told that for
Springer
year
kid, I like
after
that
year.
Term.
Not because he was a Springer, but because he had a mom in the school. That he knew what was going on and that was engaged. I said, are we okay? Yeah, we're good. We're good. He'll be fine. We're good. We waited for the gap. The gap occurred in fifth grade. The house of cards collapsed. Things got really bad. Now we have a special ed kid because we weren't back here really throwing in. And I'm not saying anything bad about the school or the teachers or anything like that. We were all in it together and managing it together. But you wait for that gap. Fortunately, we were a family that could write checks for private tutoring for a whole summer. And we were able to do access these, call people that their PhDs were in spelling, and do those kinds of things. And I think that's just a very clear example of why catching here and not waiting, because you're waiting for things to collapse. Is waiting, and that's pretty hard on kids.
Yeah, Co-Chairs Conference, Representative Springer, thank you for the really personal example. And RTI is not that easy to do. The methodology, some people call it now multi-tiered systems of support, you can call it whatever you want to call it, It's a really smart methodology. It can identify early, and it is built into the age 3 to grade 3, even though we don't precisely call it that. We've required components of it in the age 3 to grade 3 so that we can move in that direction, and that this network that I just described will help support that across the state, I think, in a really important way. The other thing that I need to pile in on this, and I sort of hate to take a second to do it, but it simply is that when Oregon set our standards up until 2009, our standards around reading were really low. And I think I've said this before, they were at the 16th percentile. I have some graphs now from Northwest Education or Evaluation System. NWEA, Northwest Evaluation Association, yes, that's right, that demonstrate precisely where our standards were set in the state of Oregon previously. And we told parents that their child was on track to reading because they could pass the third grade benchmark, and they weren't. And then the benchmark got a little harder in fifth grade, and then we found out that they weren't, if they were lucky. Or they might have passed the fifth grade benchmark, and when they got to the 10th grade, they weren't going to, because that was a much harder benchmark than was third grade and fifth grade. It was a setup, and we're paying for it. We're going to pay for it for a while, unfortunately. How you set your standards is really important. So some of the promising results. This graph is just a visual representation of the seven new districts that joined in 2013, and six of the seven showed a decrease in the number of intensive interventions needed by third graders on an average, with a decrease of 7.5%. And children who get intensive interventions are those who are likely headed toward a special ed identification. And so it really makes a significant difference in that. Oregon, you know, we currently allow compensation without question for up to 11% of students having a disability. RTI districts, typically you see a dip in the percentage of students who are identified. Statewide average is about 13.5% of all students are SPED identified. In the Tigard-Tualatin School District that leads the response to intervention initiative across the state as a contractor for the Department of Education, they identify about 10.25 year in and year out. And the children who are in those programs get excellent services. This slide. Another of the strategic initiatives was student mentoring and monitoring, and the students served were those who were failing at least one, if not two or three classes in math. Move forward.
No, it's not there. On mine.
Yeah, well, I'm missing a slide in my deck. I apologize. But it was who were receiving classes in math, English, science, and social studies, and it prepared 8th and 9th grade students who might not otherwise graduate for the rigor and planning needed to complete high school and plan for colleges and careers. Now I'm going to get all out of whack.
It was in ours, by the way.
Okay. Good deal. Thank you. I don't know what happened to mine. So advanced placement and international baccalaureate and exam fee support. This initiative provided students with funding so that they didn't have to pay for some or all the fees associated with taking AP or IB exams. Low-income students did not have to pay anything, and other students had reduced fees for AP and IB exams and IB registration fees. And we structured it so that we would ensure that we could leverage state and federal funds. So there are some federal funds that come for this purpose as well. And one of our concerns as we went to set this up was that the federal government might say that we were supplanting with our use of funds. And so we had to wait. It took great patience. Representative Comp bird dogged this with me for months as we waited for the federal government to tell us how much money we were going to have so that we wouldn't supplant. But over 1,023 IB exams and 5,071 AP exams were provided to low-income students in 13-14 through this program.
Mr. Saxton, just explain briefly how the IB credits transfer to colleges and the value, and just tell us a little story about IB, or else I can, and it'll get too long.
All right. Yes, Co-Chair Comp. There are a couple different programs, AP and IB, and they're very high-quality, high-demand programs. Teachers receive really explicit training about how to go about the instruction and what the content is that they need to cover for students to learn. And the training is wonderful, and the educators do a terrific job, typically with the students. Again, very demanding AP has a very specific set, and students take the AP exams, and typically if they score high enough, depending on the college, then those credits transfer to the college. So if they get a 3, 4, or 5 on the exam, some colleges require a 4 or 5 or whatever, but they typically transfer. And then IB is really set at an international, high international college standard, and that's why it's called International Baccalaureate, or IB. And those students can earn IB credit in some courses, or they can do what they call a full IB diploma. Typically, a full IB diploma student is going to be very competitive in college application anywhere in the world, because it's a standard that translates across the world. So they could apply to colleges any place, and do. And there's a high expectation around second language learning and so on to be a full IB diploma candidate and student. Students take the test, and again, if they pass it at a high enough level, then the colleges accept those credits as they transfer.
All right.
Well, as a parent, I just say when you're passing any of those courses, a full IB diploma moves you straight to your sophomore year in college.
Yes, Coach Aircomp, that's correct. Yep. And furthermore, one of the most impressive things I've seen in the last couple of years, I'll just throw them out a bone here, is the Woodburn School District that some years ago said, we're going to be a full IB district. Every kid in the district is expected to be at the IB level, and we're going to start in the elementary and middle and high. And I remember, disappointingly, thinking to myself, these people are crazy. Woodburn is a really hard place to move, right? And I was wrong, and they were absolutely right, because kids in Woodburn are completely capable of doing that, of course, as are kids anywhere. And their graduation rates and their success with students right now and what they're imagining that they can be, and the high standard that they're able to master, is a learning exercise for all of us and should be instructive as we even talk about Common Core, which is not at the IB level, quite frankly. It's close, but not quite.
Well, and so that other schools that are listening, IB is now at the elementary level, middle level, and at the high school level. So it's pretty awesome to have an IB program at an elementary school. Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question on that fee support structure. Were the payment of, was it based on free and reduced lunch, or did you use another indicator?
Co-Chairs Comp Monroe, Representative Smith Warner. We've used free and reduced lunch as the indicator.
Thank you.
Slide 266 is about the replication of the Eastern Promise, and it's right in the benchmark of what we should be talking about, because we just talked about being able to earn college credits while you're still in high school and move forward. And the Eastern Promise replication grants did just that, helped provide the resources needed to replicate the highly successful Eastern Promise program, which is a program that expands opportunities for high school students to earn college credits while still in high school and build a college-going culture in the local schools. What happens with the Eastern Promise is that the high school teachers and the college teachers come together and agree on what is college-level material and college-level content for learning, and then they create college-level courses that would be at the high school. The high school teacher teaches it. The student creates evidence, so they do work, and then that evidence gets turned into the college professor, who scores it and then awards the college credit. So it's a really unique way of getting at that. And one of the questions that we always have when we're awarding college credit at the high school level is, yeah, but is it college level work? And one of the things that that answers around the Eastern Promise is, well, it certainly seems that it would be if the people have gotten together through a professional learning team, the college professor and the high school teacher made some agreements, and the work is being scored by the college professor. Now, in the Western Promise, which has come out of the Willamette ESD and is a really nice piece of work that they're doing right now, they are not scoring every single piece of evidence, but every third piece of evidence, if I understand it correctly, to make sure that they have inter-rater reliability as they do this. And it's a little bit more cost-economical model, and we're going to have to review that and make sure that we keep the standard at a high level. But it's an interesting process, and that's part of the replication as you scale some of this up, to look for different ways to do it and some things that could be even more efficient than the original model. There are 5 consortia school groups right now, education service districts and or school districts, and community colleges and universities who receive the grants. Central Oregon Better Together, Connected Lane Pathways, Oregon Metro Connects, Southern Oregon Promise, and the Willamette Promise. It's really good work that's underway, and it's varying states of progress depending on which one of those grant awardees that you speak with. The Willamette Promise that I just referenced specifically has made rapid progress, and the superintendents in the region tell me that collectively, so all the districts that are part of this collective, are able to offer 1,000 hours of college credit more in their collective high schools than they were the previous year. So I know at Staten High School, they're able to offer 130 more college credit hours than they were a year ago this year. And they have some great pathway work that's underway in anticipation for next year. And if you take their 130 and then you do it in high schools across the region, it's more than 1,000 hours.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rob, sorry to interrupt you. Do any of the schools, high schools in these promise areas have the five-year high school, or are they all four-year? And then graduation rate also, as you're pondering question one, just kind of curious for, because one of the things, I was on the Accelerated Learning Task Force, and very supportive of college credits in high school, junior and senior years in particular, but I'm mostly concerned that the students that are in there are taking full loads. I'm kind of leaning toward they should be able to get through school in 4 years, and I would want to make sure that they're taking all their necessary core stuff before they start taking on accelerated, but if they do take on accelerated, wondering what kind of graduation rate that leads to. Is it really phenomenally good?
Co-chairs Comp and Rural Representative Huffman, in the Eastern Promise, we're seeing increased graduation rates on the part of those schools, and I can get you that data so that you can see it. It's part of why we were excited about replicating that. There are a few high schools that have been involved in fifth-year programs that are part of these consortia now that are scaling up the Eastern Promise work. I might have to look and get precisely which ones, but I know that there are at least a few. So Dallas High School, I think, belongs to the Western Promise, for example, and they've done that for a while. I do think it's a nice effort to try to replace the fifth-year programs. And the thing that I know as a past high school principal is I can't make a senior come to high school. Probably can't make a junior come to high school. Even their parents are going to have a really hard time with that if they don't want to. And so what you have to do is offer them a great class to take. If a student looks at their class load and says, this is going to take me someplace, I'm excited and engaged in the instruction that I'm going to have, and I've heard that that class is a great class to take, they're going to sign up and take more than a full load or all of a full load. And if you don't do that, you probably can't. So, you know, the state board recently passed some new requirements around minimum instructional hours. They're going to drive high schools to give more classes to juniors and seniors. We're going to have to fill those with great classes if the students are going to actually show up and take them. And I believe that this Eastern Promise replication helps us deliver those great classes, because when you say to a student, and this is going to be a math class that is going to be at the college level and will buy you credits for college as you move forward, and you're not going to have to spend your hard-earned money, and you can actually do that here and now, I can get that. I can get an AA. I can get my first year of college completed in my junior and senior year. And what we see is a lot of students coming out with what we call the AAOT, which is the transfer module. So it's all the courses that Oregon colleges have agreed that will transfer. So it's going to be my senior English class, my senior math class, speech, those kinds of classes that will transfer to all of the public colleges and universities in the state of Oregon. And so a lot of what schools are working on are those AAOT transfer classes.
Okay. Follow-up, Representative Huffman.
A couple of years ago, I don't think I dreamed this, but I think there's a high school in Oregon that actually has gone to, at least loosely, a six-year model. Is that true? Have you heard that, or did I imagine that?
Co-chairs Comp and Rural Representative Huffman, if you heard it 2 years ago, you're a year ahead of me. Yes, there are at least one or two high schools that have moved to 6 years. Where once you extend it to the five, you look at it and you go, where does it say that if a student doesn't receive a diploma, they can't go for six, because state law says that we're going to deliver instruction until a child reaches age 19. So if the student's young enough, they can continue to go and receive dollars from the state school fund to continue to attend. Once they reach age 19, then that should be automatically cut off. I think what we're finding is that there are a few places where people have tried to sneak in 19-year-olds, and we're chopping that off at the knees. But there are a couple places that I know that Dallas High School, for example, has had a six-year program for has had a few students going for 6 years over the last couple of years, and we need to make sure that we stop it.
Co-Chair Scott and Rowe, Representative Huffman, Sarah Pope, Chief of Staff of the Department of Education. We also see some schools starting to create seventh and, in some cases, eight-year programs as well.
And this is just blowing my mind at the moment, but these are not special ed students?
Co-Chairs Comp and Rowe, special ed students are eligible to age 21.
Right.
So they could be special education students that have, you know, are in college and are eligible then until age 21. That would be a little unusual because they would need to be receiving services, but it's not past the pale based on, you know, some of what we're finding. And certainly you don't have to be SPED. You can still receive resource until age 19, regardless of special education status.
And I believe Senator Roblin's looking at that issue in his committee.
Today.
That's what I thought.
It will be up today.
I would ask you a whole bunch of questions, but we need to finish
the question
this.
Is, with robust junior and senior years, with new rules that the State Board has passed, and with these Eastern Promise replication grants and other kinds of dual credit opportunities, can we get where we want to go without needing a fifth year? And how much money does the fifth year take out of the state school fund? Currently, it's about $10 million a biennia. If Portland Public decided to join, mm-hmm. Decided to go that way, I don't know what it would do to the state school funding formula and the amount per student, because it would increase the numbers of students that are receiving these resources. So it would drive the amount per student down because there would be more children that we would count.
And Brian Reeder has done some of that analysis that we can share if you're
yeah,
interested.
Well, and we don't want to really go into that hornet's nest this morning. Let's
move on. I'm going to keep moving. There's about $400,000 on average that's gone to these replication grants, and we're reviewing those, and many are making good progress. A couple have stumbled a little bit, but we'd like to keep pushing on that. STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. The shortages are acute in degrees relating to science, engineering, math, and technical education, as well as many other CTE fields. And this is another hands-on area that's helped pull students through high school and help them imagine their futures. STEM jobs are growing at two or three times the rate of other job categories in Oregon. And Oregon's economy has if you think about it, it's really dynamic when it comes to biomedical, high-tech, civil and mechanical engineering, manufacturing, precision agriculture, reading about drones and agriculture this morning in the newspaper, advanced food processing and construction. And so there's lots of room here. We have regional STEM hubs received $3 million, which was a convening of regional collaborations, and there were six of those across the state. We have a number of STEM activities that have been conducted over the state, with science-based activities like robotics and so forth at $2.5 million over the last 2 years, and the STEM lab schools received $2 million.
The reasons the numbers are a little different is we had the ability to move up to 15% of funds around, so when the hubs had a lot more applications, we moved some of those dollars into the hub application, so that's why the number is a little bit higher than what Rob just said.
On slide 267, this is a map where funding went to the STEM efforts, and you can see that there are regional STEM hubs that were funded. There were a few that were not. Then the STEM lab schools, and then the STEAM CTE activity locations. And I can give you a detail of each of those, but would prefer to move forward if we can.
Thank
so,
you.
I'll go to this Network for Quality Teaching and Learning. This network is really about improving the practices of teachers and administrators across the state. I've talked about that a fair amount. And there were focus areas: mentoring for new educators, education evaluation effectiveness, Common Core state standard implementation, school district collaboration grants, educator workforce that more closely mirrors student demographics, educator preparation, closing the achievement gap, and early learning professional development. And I took the time to go through each of those because they each were significant and separate effort. You can see here that when we implemented a mentoring program across the state, we done that since the 2011-2012 year. We know that teachers and administrators need real support in their first years of the profession to be better at it and to have success in it and enjoy it, actually. It's a very enjoyable profession when you're good at it, and it really stinks when you're not. It's not very fun if you're not very good at it when you're doing it. And every educator experienced a little of both. This program provided 90 hours of mentoring to each new educator based on a research-based model out of the New Teacher Center, which is out of California. There were 993 new teachers and 103 new administrators able to participate in the 2013-14 school year, and the biennial cost was $9 million. The cost for each teacher, the amount that was set aside for each teacher for a mentor was $4,000, and for each administrator, $3,800. 11 had 23 new teachers. I don't know why I keep coming up with this 11 thing. We surveyed the new teachers in the mentoring program and found a significant percentage of them believe the program contributed to their success. In fact, 85% said it contributed either some, quite a bit, or a great deal. Support to implement the Common Core in educator effectiveness. So we combined two of the pots of money around educator evaluation and then teaching to the new set of Common Core standards, because those two things are really tied together. Are you teaching to the set of standards that we expect, and how are you, what your educative effective practice looks like, because teaching to a set of standards is an effective practice. And it allowed us also to really convene in a different way than we might have been able to otherwise. And we created a set of professional learning meetings across the state and used a train-the-trainer model, where districts sent teams to the meetings, and then the teams received their training with an expectation that they would go back to their own district and train educators there. And we received very positive feedback on the whole process. I will tell you that when we started, there was lots of skepticism about whether or not the department could go out and lead effective staff development across the state, and we found that we were able to do that. We had a total of $8.6 million that flowed through to school districts for this work, and then the convening meetings we spent about $6 million on. We provided the flow-through funds on a per-student formula. Let's see, $6 million went to school districts to implement the Common Core in educator effectiveness. We convened over 1,300 educators in Portland, LaGrande, and Eugene three times last year and this year for the Professional Learning Team conferences and Professional Learning Team participation. There were 189 of the 197 school districts that participated. We had 1,393 educators each year, or each time that we offered these sessions, attend. 98% of Oregon students were represented by the school districts that attended. And the training was around English language arts, mathematics, science, inter-rater reliability, which has to do with how we evaluate educators, student learning and growth, also as part of the evaluation system, and English language proficiency. District collaboration grants. These are grants that have been held or led by the Chalkboard Project, and it's what Representative Huffman asked about earlier today. They've been highly successful, and they've led to strong professional development and improved teaching practice on the part of participating districts. And districts work to design and implement meaningful evaluation aligned to professional learning and new career pathways. And so part of what we find is that teachers sometimes find that they become a teacher and the sort of the advancement on a career pathway is hard to identify, especially if they want to stay in the classroom and be a teacher and not an administrator, for example. And so that this helps professionalize and gives them a pathway around some additional learning and opportunity at different compensation. Student achievement is higher than in non-collaboration grant districts. And on the TEL survey, which is the survey that we gave to all educators this last fall, collaboration grant districts had a more positive response in every category of leadership in schools, professional development, and teacher concerns, saying that staff there appear to be more content. We had closing the opportunity gaps grants, and these grants were specifically targeted at closing achievement gaps for our students of color. They included startup of dual language education grants. There's about $1 million for that. Developing new English language proficiency standards with $547,000. culturally responsive pedagogy and practices. That means helping teachers teach in a way that's culturally relevant so that students have access to the content through their own sort of cultural norms about how they think about things. Closing the achievement gaps for American Indian and Alaska Native students, and closing achievement gaps for African American students. The pedagogy and practices was 1.5, closing achievement gaps for Alaska Natives 850,000, and American African American students 600,000. The dual language grant recipients received $120,000, and it went to Bend Lapine, Hood River County, Jackson County, Newburgh, Portland, and Springfield. Then we had $160,000 we awarded to the NISA School District, who worked in partnership with the Four Rivers Community School, which was already a dual language immersion program and a really interesting dynamic, and the student results there are terrific. Combined educator effectiveness with the Common Core standard to support for small and rural schools. So what we recognized right away was that some of our small and rural schools were having a challenge in applying for these grants and being successful at it, and so we did a couple different things. We put some dollars aside, roughly $1 million. Some of it, there was $20,000 for 19 ESDs to hire grant writers so that the ESD could hire the grant writer to work with the small district and write competitive grants based on what it was that they were looking for. We spent about $285,000 of the million on that. And then there were 100 districts where we sent $683,000 out in an ADMW, so by a student-based formula, where it was just an automatic grant to those school districts around educator effectiveness as part of all of this work and the implementation of the Common Core. And those ran from $5,000 to $10,000 for each of those districts. We provided release time for professional learning teams and activities that the districts were expected to do that with some of those resources. This basically shows a graph where the educator effectiveness and Common Core state standards implementation resources were used across the state. So the percentage of Oregon students were involved and the percentage of Oregon districts that were involved, and then where they came from, rural, town, city, and suburb. So on slide 279, you'll see the proposed network investments for 15-17, and this is one that I know that as we talk about whether there's $60 million available, this is part of the consternation about the list of things that have been put together here. What we wanted to do here was provide a side-by-side comparison between the 13-15 funding request and the 15-17 for House Bill 32. See, this is 3233, and you can see the amount of money is basically current service, is more or less current service level, and then some focus on some different things where we're focusing on fewer grants with greater depth. So kind of walk you through those just a little bit.
Just a second, Rob. Yes. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I can focus on the rest of what Rob's saying, I want to ask my daily question. Does this $41 million come out of the $60 million? As I understood, Rob, to talk about the consternation.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
So, Co-Chairs Confident Row, I want to, this is 3233, and I'm going to answer no to that
right.
question, actually.
There's actually some
I was nodding my head, and then I changed my mind. So, there actually is a statutory stream of resource for 3233, and it's set at 33.5 million dollars out of the last session, and it's tied to any increase in the state school fund. So if the state school fund were to increase by 7%, let's say, let's pick a number, then the $33.5 million would roll up by 7%. And it is the network for quality teaching and learning, and it is now set in statute.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Yes.
So anything above that, say 7% roll-up, would then come out of the 60?
Co-Chairs Conference Rural Representative Huffman, yes, absolutely.
Okay. Representative Taylor, I can tell there's something stirring here.
That's okay. Thank you, Chair. The LFO, can you explain that, how that is going to work for us? Where is that money going to come from? I'm just curious.
Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, I would defer to Committee Administrator Doug Wilson for that question.
Okay.
And Co-Chairs Compton-Rowe, Representative Taylor, this is money that comes out of the state school fund.
Oh.
but it statutorily comes out of the state school fund for right this purpose. So it's one of the carve-outs that we identified the other day.
Okay. So it was created for the first time in 2013.
I'm told that Doug is going to go over this on Monday. What I would want to direct your eyes to is where we are at the bottom. So what happened last time is we had this, and then there were some additional funds that were taken out of the Common School Fund.
Yes.
To go from the 33.5 to the 40.6. And so, Representative Huffman, when you asked me, does it come out of the 60? Yes, maybe, but there are lots of different things that you could decide to do, like take some money out of the Common School Fund if you thought that some of the work that we were requesting was valuable enough that one might consider finding some other way to garner resources for this purpose, like out of the Common School Fund, like happened out of the last session. So, yes, and the State Land Board, I'm being told, would also need to approve that, and that's true. Well, so I look at the total.
And I was going to say, doing my homework last weekend, I read that we put $20 million out of the Common School Fund into the teacher effectiveness program.
I was thinking 12, but it was 20?
20.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure, because once I read it, it sticks, so.
Thank you, Representative Comp. So you see the amounts that we're asking for remain relatively the same. It's a CSL level roll-up, basically. But you'll also see that there are some things that we did in 13-15 that we're not asking to replicate in 15-17. So the mentoring would be an increase. There are more new teachers now than there were previously. The school district collaboration grant that's worked through well through our work with Chalkboard, we asked for an increase. And then the support of the Common Core, state standards implementation, we've reduced that amount a little bit, not asking for more work on Senate Bill 290 evaluation because we've done that. It should be cemented or in the process of being cemented across the state. And then I'm going to move on down and say the other place is around support for underperforming districts. And that, as you know, I talked yesterday about focus and priority work, and there are some places it seems difficult to move individual schools because there's a district issue, not a school issue necessarily, or it's a combination of the two. We've spent a lot of time trying to figure out how you identify low-performing districts, and quite honestly, when we look at districts that are in the bottom, if we try to identify the bottom 10 districts in multiple categories, like how much did students grow in reading from third grade to eighth grade, or math from third grade to eighth grade, or graduation rate, or four-year cohort graduation rate, or dropout rate, we can find a consistency of districts in the bottom 10. Some districts that are in the bottom 10 in every category. When we look at that, those districts need support, and we cannot continue to leave students in those districts and not help those districts. We're asking for $3 million roughly to do that, and then 2.4 to create the leaders that can lead those districts out of that predicament and those schools out of that predicament in partnership with some other providers. You can see that what we've tried to say is let's go deeper where we're doing really good work and let's let go of some of the multiplicity, you know, the many things where we've learned that they work, but it doesn't scale up across a system. So we're asking for larger sums in fewer places in work that we've identified where we know it works and that we're having good result. It's not that we haven't had good result other places, but everything works in education. Everything works. You have to pick what works best. And that's what we're trying to do with this resource allocation. I would identify something similar in 32-32. Again, on this one, however, you'll see that the dollar request goes up from 23.8 to 37.5. And that there are some additional things that are asked for instead of fewer. And so here were the things that we did in 15-17, and if you look down the list in what we're requesting for in 15-17, this is 13-15. You'll see that they add up to 37.5. A couple of I know that we're going to go over these on Monday, and so I'm happy to walk through every one because it's a significant request, but I also want to make sure that I'm thoughtful about time.
Thank you.
Serve at the pleasure.
And for the committee, this is the chart that Doug's been working on for a couple of weeks. It's that he has ready to share with us. He had it ready Tuesday, but we still haven't gotten there. So wrap it up.
Yes, we have other required information that's in different sections of this report, and I know that there are links to all of that, and we have that information that's available to you, and I think that it's part of the copy that you received, and so I won't walk through all of those, and that would be my last slide. I would happily go over any questions on slide 280 if you feel like I'm leaving something out when this is a really big request, actually.
Comments or thoughts from the committee?
Wouldn't dream of it, Madam Chair.
Good choice. Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Kump. Obviously, all of these are important, but can you maybe identify some that would be more important or ones that you would really want to have combined with something else, like you couldn't really have one without the other or something like that?
Co-Chairs Kump and Rowe, Representative Taylor, thank you for putting me on the spot.
Sorry.
I talked quite a bit about the Eastern Promise Replication Grant, and it's one that I think that we're on the verge of a breakthrough here, and we've had a breakthrough in some places, and other places still need some additional resource, and we need to finish this work, and we're right there, and we're seeing students who are earning college credits while they're still in high school, making their junior and senior year robust. It moves us away from a fifth year program philosophy. And I also think that the partnerships that are created between college professors and high school teachers and the learning that takes place there is really valuable. I just think it's a place that some continued focus is going to move the dial significantly. This tribe's attendance pilot, $1.5 million, is a creation of an attendance program.
Help attendance me. Works. Attendance work.
Yeah, out of. Go ahead, please, sir.
Couldn't tell if he wanted me to just whisper it to him or
there
say
you
it.
Tell
so
it.
In partnership with Attendance Works, national-based attendance organization.
And there would be dollars that would go to the tribes, and they would need to partner with their school districts improving attendance for Native American students who are tribal members. And I don't know if you've seen the report that was created last year in partnership with the tribes and Echo Northwest, but this is something that we've got to do in order to turn around the results that we're seeing with our Native American students here in the state. And I'm going to leave it at that for
okay,
the
okay.
short term.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I think that completes Mr. Saxon's presentation. And Lisa, do you have your presentation ready, or how do we find it?
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, that presentation saved under March 16th's hearing date.
Thank you so much.
Clarification?
Yes, sir.
So, Paul, it was under March 3rd, so it's evolved into being saved under the 16th now, so that we know where to find it.
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, I found it under the 16th while I was sitting here. I don't know where it was before that.
Good. Thanks.
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, my name is Lisa Pearson with the Chief Financial Office, and I think it was originally the 9th, but it may have been moved to the 16th. And I'm going to present a very brief summary of the past 3 weeks of testimony on the governor's budget for education. So, reaching back to the presentation from the Policy Advisor and the Oregon Education Investment Board Chief Education Officer, the budget was developed with a 10-year vision of everybody in Oregon having the knowledge and skills for rewarding careers. The overarching strategy is 40-40-20 by 2015. The overarching lens was equity and the achievement gap. And then you may recall there were three pathways. The two pathways that are most directly related to the Education Department are in bold, and those are kindergarten readiness and third grade reading, and high school and post-secondary completion. So investments in the kindergarten readiness pathway include full-day kindergarten at $220 million, early learning investments, and you can read all of that, but that totals $139 million, early literacy is $85 million, and then early learning is $139 million. And then finally, the culturally responsive aspect of all of these investments totals about $10.8 million. And then the second pathway is the connecting education to career. That includes the CTE, or Career and Technical Education Programs. There was an addition of $14.7 million in the governor's budget. And then the Science, Technology, Engineering, and Mathematics, STEM, received in the governor's budget $7.9 million more than the 2013-15 legislatively approved budget. So that then brings us to a quick summary of where we were in 2013-15, legislatively approved versus the proposal. This groups the pass-through budgets, the grants, and the state school fund together. These are not directly spent by state agencies on state agency-delivered programs. And the main point here is that while there is a 7% increase overall between the two biennia, the state school fund has 2% less of a share overall between these different programs than it did in 2013-15. And that 2% helps pay for the 1% increase in grant aid for early literacy, and also 1% increase in early learning grants that go out the door. And then this slide shows the comparison between the direct expenditures by state agencies, including the department, and that is a decrease slightly due to the debt service that was scheduled. So it was just a normal kind of process. The debt service ended, and it was a significant decrease.
That's huge.
The next slide shows the state school fund only. It's been discussed quite a bit, and I don't think we need to discuss it anymore, unless anybody wants to, but. The governor's budget would need a technical adjustment to move the early intervention, early special EISCE investment from early learning. That's the $15 million investment to grant and aid, which is where all of that money flows through anyway. And finally, this is a comparison to the co-chair's framework from early January. And the governor's budget was $340 million less than the co-chair's state school fund budget. And that includes $34 million in the co-chair's framework for high-cost disability grants. The thing I should mention here is when you get to the end of the comparisons for the state school fund, the governor's budget did not include the roll-up from the 2013 special session. So regardless of whether you look at current service level, the way the governor did it, or the way the legislative fiscal office did it, you basically wind up at the same place, except for the $200 million that was related to that legislative special session. So then the governor's budget also did not have $20 million depending on the revenue forecast in May, because obviously we depended on December. And then possible capital assistance for the kindergarten full day K effort. Strategic initiatives and network for quality teaching, the best we could tell from the January information was that the amount was $64.4 million, while the framework is in the governor's budget, and the framework is current service level at $48.7 million. But of course, as we just heard, a lot of this is in flux. And then co-chairs early learning, STEM, and CTE programs in the January information appeared to be $60 million. The early learning amount was $85 million larger in the governor's budget. It's important to remember, though, that about $50 million of that is actually in the Department of Human Services. And so that would make it about $35 million difference. And the $50 million was mentioned, well, let me put it this way. The framework in January for Human Services did say that they wanted to fund the early, the employment-related daycare piece. We just don't know if that means at the level the governor proposed or at some other level, but there's something in there. And that's a very quick summary of what you've heard for the past 3 weeks.
Any questions for Lisa? Clarifications? Yes, we all need to do a little deep breathing and see how we're going to work through all this. with that, then I close this hearing. Okay, I want to close the public hearing on.
What? Before your gavel, I have one question. Thank you, Co-Chair Comp. Can you just go over the ERDC with the Human Services? Can you just go over all that again in a little more detail, please? Explain how that's.
Certainly, Co-Chair Comp, Representative Taylor. The governor's framework, or the presentation documents for the governor, always identified $55 million for employment-related daycare and improvements to daycare. Okay. In the actual technical document, $49.6 million of that $55 million is located in the Department of Human Services, which operates an employment-related daycare program. Oh. Okay. And that's for additional slots. $5.4 million remains in the education budget for the improvement piece. In the co-chair's framework in January, there was a mention that they wanted to support the employment-related daycare investment. There wasn't any number attached to it. There wasn't any, sort of percentage comparison attached to it. So we know that there's something in there. We just don't know how much in comparison to the governor's budget.
Thank you. Okay.
Okay. Madam Co-Chair, Monroe and Comp, members of the committee, I just want to thank you for your attention to this whole presentation. I know it was kind of long, but also just your commitment that you've made to this committee and to education and kids in the state. So just thank you very much for the work you're doing. Appreciate it.
Well, we all appreciate your work, and the detail is good. Whether it takes a long time, it's really important for us to make good decisions. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5016, House Bill 5617. And Mr. Cannon, are you okay with waiting till Monday? I appreciate you coming, and this way, we have a little bit of a break before we go to our 10 o'clock meetings. And so, unless anybody has any other comments for the good of the order, we're adjourned.